First chapter, the tractate, the Masechet Kiddushin, Kaf Tet, Amud Aleph, 29a. It is about a quarter of the way down the page. We begin with the Mishnah. And remember that when you're reading the traditional text, the Mishnah is Mem Tav Nun Yud, that's the Aramaic for Matnita, for Mishnah. And we quickly read the Mishnah. This, in fact, is the seventh Mishnah of the first chapter of Kiddushin. And it's with that that I would like to begin, go right into the text, and we'll look at it and analyze it. Well, even before that, though, let me just distribute some of these things. I have enough. I'm not sure how many I have made. Either I had 20 or 25. If I had 25, we're okay. This subject that we introduced last time, when we quickly read the Mishnah, you will remember that the Mishnah discusses, among other subjects, the subject of the mitzvot that are obligatory to women, and those mitzvot from which women are free. They are not obliged to observe those mitzvot. That is going to be a returning subject. We will deal with it a little bit tonight because we are going to read the Mishnah with more care than we did last time. But in fact, it'll only be by and by that we'll deal with this. It won't be dealt with head on until about another five daf into the Talmud. So when we get there, we'll focus on the subject specifically. But frankly, I don't see how you can read this Mishnah and start thinking about the subjects that we'll be dealing with without thinking about why is it that women are not obligated to the time-bound positive commandments. So I think it's just a natural thing to want to know at least how to begin to think about it. And so even though I don't want to address it fully, because we'll never get through the Mishnah, frankly. You could spend a whole year just discussing that issue and what the different ways are of thinking about it. Even though I don't want to do it, I still do want it. I do want to do it, and I don't want to do it. But I don't want to do only that, but I can't not do that because it's compelling. So my compromise is that I'm going to give you an article. And the article is by my friend Rabbi Saul Berman, who is at Stern College, the Dean of Stern College, one of the leading modern Orthodox thinkers. And he wrote an article several years ago in Tradition magazine called The Status of Women in Halachic Judaism. And it's perhaps the most straightforward, least apologetic approach to the subject. It's fairly comprehensive. And I wanted to give you that to begin with so that you could, at your leisure, in the next few weeks, read this over. I'll make reference to some of the issues that he raises. Later on in the year, I want to actually deal with his specific view of the subject, because I think it's an important view to look at, as well as the views that he rejects, which I think are also more important to look at than he would want to say. And then, undoubtedly, as you might imagine, I actually have my own view on the subject, so I wouldn't mind sharing that a little bit once we learn everybody else's. So I will pass this out to you and take one home. And let's see whether you have enough to go around. This I took off the internet, by the way, so it's got a few weird things about it, but it's basically there. I mean, you'll notice when you read it, you'll say, why all the typos? Because that's how Tradition is on the internet. Tradition is the name of the magazine put out by the Rabbinical Council of America, which is the modern Orthodox rabbinical organization.
What year is this from?
I don't know. That's one of the problems that I have with this. Yes, correct. The language, you'll see as soon as you read the language is immediately dated. It's dated.
When was it written?
I don't know. I would guess about 20 years ago or so. That would be my guess. But I honestly don't know. I think I have every tradition magazine going back to about 1966 or 7 upstairs. And I just didn't want to go through all of them. So I went through the indices on the internet. So I found the article, because I knew it was there somewhere. And so you get the article, and you pay a few dollars to get a reprint of the article. And I, of course, I assumed that they would tell you when it was, what volume it was, what page number it was, and so on. Didn't tell you anything.
It's after 72.
It's after 72. I would guess from the language and the approach that it's about 20 years old. That's my guess. Rabbi Bleich is the rabbi of the Yorkville Synagogue on 77th, 78th. 78th and First Avenue.
All First Avenue.
But this is Rabbi Berman's. He's not the author here. He also had an article in this edition, this particular edition of Tradition. But this is it's Rabbi Berman's view that Rabbi Berman has a very good background in law. And so he puts things in a legal perspective, which I think is very helpful. Okay, let's go to the Mishnah now. Kol mitzvot ben al av, anashim chayvim anashim peturat. All of the obligations of the son upon the father, men are obligated and women are exempt. Now, the first thing that one has to say when you say that in English or in Hebrew is that it doesn't make any clear sense. What does it mean? All of the obligations of the son upon the father, that means obligations the son has toward the father? Or obligations of the son upon the father, those obligations which the father has for the son? Either one is a possible reading of those words in English or in Hebrew. So that you can see there's a problem, the text is somewhat problematic in the way it presents itself. But that's what it says. The whole mitzvot ha'av alaben, all of the obligations of the father which are on the son, echad anashim v'echad nashim chayavim, both men and women are equally obligated. The whole mitzvot aseh shazman grama, all those mitzvot which are positive commandments, that is to say, with the Torah, or at least our understanding of the Torah is such that it is something you are supposed to do. And, not only that, that you are supposed to do it at a fixed time. Okay? And not only that, you are supposed to do it at a fixed time, and if you don't do it at that fixed time, you can't do it. Now, all of those are important in what I just said. I'll give you some examples. Mitzvah taseh shazman grama, let us say the mitzvah of sukkah. Is there any mitzvah of sukkah now? There is no mitzvah of sukkah now. There is no mitzvah of sukkah until the 15th day of the month of Tishrei. And after the 22nd day of the month of Tishrei, there's no mitzvah of sukkah again, until the next 15th day of the month of Tishrei. So that is a mitzvah which is a positive commandment, because the Torah says, you shall dwell in Sukkot for 7 days. Okay? And it tells us, you know, in other verses, when those 7 days are. They're not in the springtime. They are in the month of the seventh month, start in the middle of the seventh month. So that's a positive commandment that is governed by time. The mitzvah of shofar. It is a mitzvah to hear the blowing of the shofar. Is it a mitzvah today to hear the blowing of the shofar? No. I could blow the shofar, but I haven't fulfilled any mitzvah. There is no mitzvah today to blow the shofar. There is a mitzvah, in effect, once a year. The odd thing is that it lasts for 2 days. But it lasts for 2 days, and only for 2 days. And there's simply no mitzvah at any other time. It is a positive commandment, understood by the rabbis to be a positive commandment of the Torah. And it is bound by time. As a result of that, women are not obligated by that mitzvah. Okay? Tefillin. Okay? Tefillin are not so obvious that they are time-bound from the Torah. It says, Ukshatam la'ot al yadecha. You shall bind them for a sign upon your arm. The Torah doesn't say when you shall bind them for a sign upon your arm. Right? Only by exegesis do we come to understand where it is. So it's not explicit in the Torah, but the rabbinic tradition is such that it is understood that there are at least times when you cannot put on tefillin, such as, for example, on the Sabbath. Why? Because the Sabbath says, Ot Heliolam, it is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel. Okay? Since it is a sign forever, it is a sign, Tfilin are Ukshartem La'ot Ayadecha, you shall bind them for a sign upon your arm. When you have the sign of the Sabbath, you do not have the sign of Tefillin. When you do not have the sign of the Sabbath, you have the sign of Tefillin. Right? So by exegesis, then, we come to see that Tefillin, in fact, does have times which are times that you must do and times when you're not allowed to. It becomes then a mitzvah which is a time-bound mitzvah. Although, I would note that it's not quite as compelling as the first two examples I gave you. Not quite as compelling. Okay? We had to work harder to figure out that it was time-bound.
Why doesn't Ot Heliolam mean it sort of mix the time-boundedness
Well, Ot Heliolam is the Sabbath. No,
oh,
it's not tefillin.
No,
it's not. So the Sabbath is forever.
Oh, I see. The Sabbath is forever.
The Sabbath is forever, right.
Forever.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, sorry.
So we learned by maybe Gzerah Shavah. There's two words. The word Ot in this context. The word Ot in another context. We put the two of them together and we learn something about each from each context.
I got confused in the first sentence, okay, where it says, in respect to all obligations of the son upon the father, men are obligated and women are exempt. Why do women enter in it at all? We're talking about the obligations of just two people, the son and the father. In the first part of the sentence, where do the women come in?
Well, it could be that that's a shorthand to say children. You know, it could be that when we say son, we really mean son and daughter.
But where did the women count? It says the obligations of men upon the son. All obligations of the son upon the father.
Mm-hmm.
From the children to the father, or fathers to the children, are obligated, that women are exempt. Where did the women come in?
First of all, we don't know what the sentence means. So it's a little hard to say what it should mean as far as women go. But why not, in any context, as soon as we have the word son, why not include son and daughter?
Okay, so then the sentence says, in respect to all obligations upon the son and daughter, upon the father, mm-hmm. men are exempt, and men are obligated, and women are exempt. They're talking about the obligation of the father.
How do you know?
It says so.
No. So maybe it's the obligations of the son toward the father. And maybe it means toward the father and not the mother. Or maybe it means the son but not the daughter.
So what does that mean?
You've got to have patience here. All I'm trying to show you is that there are some things that we can understand in this Mishnah rather simply. And some things the Mishnah itself begs for us to ask further questions. It will require clarification. Okay? Yes?
It says in many places, B'nai Israel, the children of Israel. It doesn't say B'nai V'benot Israel.
Have patience. Have patience. Okay? Now, so I just was trying to illustrate to you the meaning of the phrase mitzvat aseh shehazman grama. It is a positive commandment which is literally caused by time. Positive commandment caused by time. There are other positive commandments that are not caused by time. For example, the mitzvah to put up a mezuzah. There's no time that you're supposed to put up a mezuzah. You're supposed to put up a mezuzah on your door. Right? It doesn't matter whether it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
But not on Shabbat.
But you can do it on Shabbat, true. But it doesn't say when you have to do it. Okay?
Can you do it before Tfilat Shacharit?
Yeah, sure, why not? You could do it at midnight. You could do it any time you want. Okay?
What if you move to a new house? You have to do it right away?
You should do it, but what if you don't do it? Right? Remember what I said before. If you don't blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, it's not going to do you one nickel of good to blow it tonight. Right? If you don't put up the mezuzah when you're supposed to put it up, you should put it up tonight. If you haven't put it up yet, you live in the apartment 32 years. You go home tonight, you put up the mezuzah. All right. 32 years later, you blow the shofar and it's not on Rosh Hashanah. You didn't do anything. You didn't do anything. So that's the difference. Okay? So that's mitzvat aseh. There's a mitzvat aseh in general and a mitzvat aseh shazman grama. A mitzvat aseh, a positive commandment caused by time. So we see here again to look at this. Chol mitzvot aseh, all positive commandments, shazman grama, which are time caused. Anashim chayavim, men are obligated by those commandments. Vinashim paturot, and women are free from those commandments. The whole mitzvah aseh shelo azman grama, every positive commandment which is not bound by time. Okay? Echad anashim v'echad nashim chayavim. Both men and women are equally obligated. So take the example that I gave of mezuzah. Who's obligated by mezuzah, men or women?
Both.
Both, equally. There's no difference. There's no difference. Okay? Tzedakah. Tzedakah is not bound by time. A woman has exactly the same obligation as a man does. Okay? Now, part of the issue, keep in mind, when we're clarifying this, some things seem to be obvious, and you will see some things are not so obvious. For example, by saying that a woman is free from those obligations, what is that tantamount to saying? Is that tantamount to saying she is not allowed to do it? She shouldn't do it?
No.
She could do it if she wants to do it?
Maybe.
None. Oh, thank you very much. Maybe. Maybe. All of the above. How do we know for sure? And it can be more serious because you know when you observe a mitzvah, when you observe the mitzvah, the way we do it, the way the tradition is, when we observe the mitzvah of blowing the shofar, the shofar blower just doesn't get up and blow the shofar. He says, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam asher kideshanu b'mitzvotah v'tzivanu. Okay? You always have to say a formula ahead of it because you are about to observe a mitzvah. So the question will then be, how about if a woman does one of these mitzvot? Even if she can do it, if she's allowed to do it, and she does do it, does she send a bracha? You don't think so? You wonder about that, don't you? Just think, go back, see how your memory is, if you can remember back as far ago in the distant past as Sukkot. Right? The mitzvah of lulav. Or the mitzvah of sukkah. Sukkah is the easy one. We go up on the roof. Now, I'm pretty careful about these things. I'm not the worst that you'll ever meet, but I'm fairly careful. So when we go up on the roof, Did you ever hear me say, all right, and now the men will recite the blessing to be in the sukkah? I never said that.
No.
I never said that. Why? Makes you wonder why.
You
see, I'm trying to set up the problems here.
Wow.
We have some context. We have some literary statements here. They're somewhat clear and somewhat unclear. And we are going to, therefore, have to engage in a tremendous amount of clarification. Yes?
About lighting a candle.
That's a good question. How about lighting candles?
That's an application. Women do that.
Uh-huh.
Basically. That's a good question.
You know,
with a bracha. So what's the answer to that? Anybody want to venture it?
That's mitzvah to sell isha.
The answer is no. It is it's a mitzvah that is equally incumbent on men as on women. Correct. If a woman is not present, a man has to light it. And it's only by custom that women do it. But if a man lives by himself, he has the obligation to light candles. You got that. You know, okay.
But it's constrained by time.
It's time. She should be exempt.
What?
It's time.
It's a time. It's a time.
She should be exempt.
Well, that's correct. So there is a problem, isn't there?
So she shouldn't do it.
The end of it. But do you think that women are not obligated to light candles? Yeah, but I'm telling you, from your practical experience, you've been around the block a few times. Do you think women are not supposed to light candles?
You asked two different questions.
What?
You asked women are not supposed to or not obligated to.
All right, answer both of them. So obligated, you don't know the answer to that, so just tell me supposed to, from your experience. All right? Of course they're supposed to. So obviously there's got to be another something functioning here as well. There are obviously things that a woman is required. A woman is required, among other things, to make kiddush. To make kiddush is a positive commandment of the Torah, which is done only on the Sabbath. Uh-huh. So it's obviously somewhat more complicated issue. There are certain conditions, and we will see what these conditions are, which in fact create extenuating circumstances. In fact, where the positive commandment is connected to a whole series of things that also have a negative commandment. Okay? Where the positive and the negative are in fact connected to each other intimately so, then suddenly this exemption that we've read about will no longer pertain. But we'll get to that in greater detail. Yes.
What about the whole idea of Shemrat Shabbat? That's a time-constrained
thing. Correct.
Assuming that women...
So, all right, I'll spill the beans just to answer the questions. Spilling the beans is as follows. The Torah says, you shall not do any manner of labor on the Sabbath. That is a negative commandment. Since you have a negative commandment and positive commandments that in effect come out of the general structure of the negative commandment, the positive commandment becomes equally obligatory with the negative commandment.
So Shmurat the Shabbat means don't.
Correct. And as opposed to those are the two words you have in the Torah. The Ten Commandments is repeated twice. One is Shamor, Shabbat HaKadosh, the other is Zachor. Zachor is a positive commandment. Shamor is the negative commandment. Since they both appear in the Ten Commandments, the positive and the negative then have equal weight with each other. And that the one who is obligated by the one becomes obligated by the other. And therefore men and women are equal as far as the laws of the Sabbath are concerned. Okay? But now you will see that I've just described to you a special case. And you will see as we go into the text now that the special cases are going to be defined by the text. By the text. I had to define it to you because I said Zachor and Shamor. Right? One was positive, one was negative. Both in the text. Both you would think mean the same thing. They are understood to mean opposite things in a way. One positive, one negative. Right? So we will require, in fact, a variety of textual proofs to explain a tremendous number of details, and we will see there are many, many shades of gray here, that while we've defined things as if it's black and white, it's not going to be quite as black and white as it seems. Okay, and I'll get to one in greater detail a little later on.
What came first, the interpretation of text or the desire of people to say?
Oh, who knows? That I can't answer at this stage. All right. All I am showing you is that this is what the Mishnah says. And I'm just trying to sensitize us to the fact that the simple Mishnah is, of course, not simple. Not simple in terms of what it says. And then even the concepts, while they are not all that complicated, the concepts immediately raise issues. Which, of course, is going to be the subject of the Gemara. That's the function of the Gemara.
Are there separate mitzvot?
What do you mean by separate?
Let's say men shall do this, period, not women.
Men shall do this. Maybe. You'll see. Hold your horses. Okay? I don't want to spill all the beans, because you're going to see even in the Mishnah itself, it's going to refer to a little bit of that. Okay? Now, we go on. The whole mitzvot lo taseh, all negative commandments, bein shehazman grama, bein shelo hazman grama, whether they are caused by time or they are not caused by time, such as you shall do no manner of labor on the Sabbath. Okay? That's another negative commandment. Think of something else we're not allowed to do.
Do not kill.
Do not kill. Okay? Do not murder. Okay?
Laws of kashrut.
You shall not eat these animals. Correct. Okay? What? Do not make an image. Right? All of these are negative commandments. You shall not do this. Right? You shall not steal. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not covet. Okay? Whole bunch of negative commandments. Because they're negative, whether they are time-bound or they are not time-bound, echad anashim ve'echad nashim chayabim. Both men and women are equally obligated. Okay?
What does it mean, titana lemeitim?
I didn't get to that yet. Chutz mi bal takif, ubal tashchit, ubal titame lemeitim. With the exception of three negative commandments that in fact are obligatory upon men, but not upon women. There are three such commandments. Here the Mishnah is giving you apparently all the possible exceptions to the rule. And now, what do they mean? Bal takif. There is a mitzvah that says, mitzvah of the Torah that says, you shall not cut around the hair of your head all the way around at the temples. Okay? That apparently must have been a pagan custom. You see that there are pictures of pagans like that even till today. Some of them are on Broadway and Park Avenue. It's a hairstyle that people have. It was apparently really a pagan hairstyle. Now it's just a certain kind of weirdo modern hairstyle. Where people shave all the way around, and then the hair is on the top of the head, but there's nothing from the forehead all the way around. Okay, that's the mitzvah of bal takif. You shall not surround your head with this cutting.
No,
okay, around the perimeter, correct. Now that is a negative commandment, which is not incumbent upon women. Not incumbent upon women. The next one is bal tashchit. Bal tashchit pa'atzachan zekancha. You shall not destroy the sides of your beard. The sides of your beard. No, as a result of that, it's been an ancient tradition among Jews to wear beards, for men to wear beards. Whole question of whether it is permissible to shave is a real question. If you look at ancient pictures, for example, I was just looking at the new issue of the Biblical Archaeological Review, just came 2-3 days ago. There's a picture in there where they are trying to describe, they've got a picture from some ancient stele that goes back maybe to the, referring to the Abiru as perhaps Proto-Hebrews referred to in the Bible. So the picture, it's an interesting picture because the guy's got a beard. Okay, he's got a nice beard. You go over to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and look at the pictures of the Egyptians. You'll see that the Egyptians are clean-shaven, with the exception of certain royal beards. Royal beards. I mean, I found that fascinating. They did an exhibit a few years ago of sort of Roman-era Egyptian paintings at the Met. And I was just fascinated to see the hairstyles of the men and the women to some extent. The hairstyles of the women, of course, are the hairstyles up here. But the men were clean-shaven. Fascinating to see the men. Think of a Roman, the pictures of the Roman emperors, the statues of the Roman emperors. They're all clean-shaven. They're all clean-shaven. So it was, however, back to the Torah, a law of the Torah that men are not allowed to bal tashchit, to destroy the hair on the sides of their beards. That's literally, I'm translating very literally now. What exactly that refers to also is not so easy to know. Okay, or what refers to what part of the face it refers to, number one, and what it means not to destroy it, number two. Refer to two things. First of all, you've heard of peot, peis. Okay? That is one of the possible ways of observing such a law, perhaps. Maybe it means that you shall really let the stuff grow very long. All right? Pa'atzan is a kancha, the sides of your zakan. These are the peot of the face. So maybe it means to grow that long. And you know that in certain parts of the Jewish community, that's a custom. It's a custom that's coming back, by the way. It's coming back. It's coming back among the modern Orthodox. And not in America, in Israel. Your kids have peyot, your grandchildren? No? Not yet. Wait till you see their great-grandchildren. You'll see. It's coming back. It's coming back. Very interesting. It's a sort of a cool way to look. All the settler kids, the modern Orthodox settler kids, all the peyot. That's only one possibility, though. Another thing, I remember I went to, several years ago, I went to Mir, to the yeshiva of Mir. I went to the yeshiva of Mir in Mir. I went to Mir in Belarus, Poland. Went back and forth between those places. It's Belarus now. I was in Belarus. So we went to the yeshiva of Mir. I had a colleague of mine, Rabbi Johnny Porath. Do you know Rabbi Porath? Rabbi Porath's father is Rabbi Tzvi Porath. The late Rabbi Tzvi Porath was a rabbi in Washington, D.C. His whole career in Washington. Johnny grew up there. He made Aliyah many years ago, and he was a professor of Russian studies, and then he became involved in Russian Aliyah. Eventually he made a specialty of taking tour groups from Israel to Russia, Russia to Israel. And so Johnny met us in Belarus, Porath, and he had a whole bunch of pictures that were taken of the students of the Mir Yeshiva before the Nazi era. So I was fascinated, just absolutely fascinated, because I know the Mir students in Israel. And I was fascinated to see the Mir students in Mir, you know, the real thing, not the after the fact. The real thing in Mir, there wasn't a student with a beard. They were all clean shaven. Every student in Mir Yeshiva was clean shaven. How can it be? It says, Bal Tashchit Pa'atzakancha. you shall not destroy the sides of your beard. How could it be? Well, the answer is that to that also there's a history. What does it mean to destroy? Is the electric razor the same as a razor? Is a scissors the same as a razor? And what is the electric razor? Is it a scissors or is it a razor? So none of these things is clear on the surface. None is clear on the surface. However, what we see here, though, is that that is a negative commandment which women are not obligated to observe. You could even imagine, I'm not going to tell you what the Gemara says, but probably your mind could figure out already where the Gemara will go to explain why that would be. And finally, there's one other exception, and that is Bal Titameh Lametim. You shall not defile yourselves for the dead. That is referring to the Kohanim, the priests. The priestly class is prohibited to come into contact with death. That's true to this day.
Unless it is accidental.
Accidental is not a prohibition. You can't be prohibited against having an accident. Right?
No, so, but the minute if the Kohen walks the street and there is, then he needs to do what he needs to do like anybody else.
If there's nobody else around, he has to call out first.
Oh, you mean, what do you say? Oh, if the Kohen has, you mean if there's somebody dies.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's an exception to the Kohen rule, that the Kohen, in fact, has to take care of the dead person if no one else is available to do it. No one else is available to do it. But the basic law is that a Kohen is not allowed to be involved with these things. The Kohen can't go to the cemetery. Kohen can't go to a funeral chapel unless it's for certain immediate relatives. Then the Kohen is permitted to do it.
Even the son for the father?
I said certain immediate relatives. But not for anybody.
Shiva
not for anybody. Shiva is different because the deceased is not present at the Shiva. But the Kohen is prohibited in coming in contact. Now, women Kohanim are not required to observe that. They are not required to observe that.
In Hungary, the Kohanim bury on the border of the cemetery.
Mm-hmm. Even in this country.
And if the Kohen comes to the cavern and stay outside of the
correct. Cemetery. We have, when we made our cemetery doors Arua, I kept some graves in the front for the Kohanim.
So that Kohen?
Because there are Kohanim, there is a view that the Kohen can go on the road. You do the same thing, Yerushal? Kohen can go on the road, but not into the actual, once you pass the barrier into the actual cemetery itself. So we are actually have sold some of the graves at the very front of our cemetery to Kohanim, and I've reserved others just to have that leeway so that Kohanim will be able to do that if they should so desire. Okay? Now, the point is here that we had a general principle, which was that women are obligated by negative commandments. This is a negative commandment. But for some reason, and we don't yet know what that reason is, we say that women are free from that obligation. Okay? Now, the Mishnah comes, as I said to you last time, without any disagreements. Okay? No disagreements. When you read the Mishnah, I think one of the things that you perforce want to ask yourself is, why all these things? Does the Torah tell us this? Are these traditions? Are these from God? Are these created by the rabbis? Where does all of this stuff come from? Okay? Now keep in mind what the Mishnah is. The Mishnah, 200 CE, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, edits a edition of the law that undoubtedly existed before him, and he excludes a tremendous amount of material from it. It is an oral type of literature. It's conveyed orally, and it has its own style. Frequently, it will preserve arguments on a particular subject, although frequently it doesn't. There may be arguments, and we just don't have them in the Mishnah. Okay? the theology of the thing is that I think one would like to know how absolute these obligations are, even as we deal with a problem that in fact impinges upon our own lives, such as women. That's a very modern issue. That's an issue that we want to have direction. We want to know whether what we have just read is as absolute as it appears to be. Can it be interpreted? Is it this way because of something that the Torah itself clearly says? Is this something that is as much a mitzvah as the mitzvah of the Sabbath, and it's maybe a procedural or legal type of mitzvah? You know, by procedural, I mean these are procedural issues we're dealing with, whether men are obligated, women are obligated. I kind of want to know what the source of all of this is. Well, the Gemara will make an effort to elucidate at least a part of that. And the Gemara, of course, will also elucidate what's not clear. The very first piece of the Mishnah was not clear, and so we will see now that that is certainly the first issue that the Gemara tries to clear up. And keep in mind that there are a variety of ways that you can clear up ambiguous statements. Sometimes it's to find another statement that's less ambiguous. Other times it's to argue logically, to present a logical argument which simply clarifies something that is appeared at least to be ambiguous. Okay, so let us turn to the Gemara. The Gemara, the first thing the Gemara asks is, "My kol mitzvot haben alaav." What is the meaning of all of the mitzvot of the son on the father? What? Okay, what is the meaning of that? My. What is the meaning of it? Just trying to clarify the meaning. And here it sets up the first possibility. Ilema kol mitzvot demechayev bara lemevad le'aba. If we say that it means all of the mitzvot that the son is obligated to do for the father, right? I'll give you an example. A mitzvah that a son is obligated says, honor thy father and thy mother. Right, that's a mitzvah that a son is obligated to do for the father. So is that what we're talking about? It could be that that's what we're talking about. Okay. So the first possibility is Ilema kol mitzvot mechayim bara lemei bad abba nashim peturot. The first part of the Mishnah said that women are not obligated by this. That would mean all of the things that the child is obligated to do for the parent, automatically women are free from that obligation. V'hatanya, but don't you remember that there is a baraita that teaches, in fact, the opposite? Ish. Now, in the Gemara itself, it's coming very shorthand. The Torah says in the Parashat Kedoshim, Ish imo v'aviv tirao. Ish imo v'aviv tirao. Literally, a man, Ish, Imo, his mother, Ve'aviv, his father, you shall revere. Okay? In other words, that Ish shall revere. Okay? So that's what's being referred to, that verse of the Torah. It requires that the child express reverence to the parent. Ish ein li ela ish. Here I would know if it says ish, what does an ish mean? It's a man. So ein li ela ish, this should just mean a man. That would mean that men children have an obligation of revering the parent, but women children don't. If ish means ish, if it means a man. Ein li ela ish. Ish aminayim. How do we know that a woman child has the same obligation? Kishahu omer ish imo v'aviv tirao, since it says, a man, his mother and his father, you shall revere, hare kan shnayim. This is said in the plural. Hare kan shnayim, this is here the plural. Now, it's very clever, very careful reading of the text. Ish imo v'aviv tirao. The subject of the verse is the word ish, man. Singular subject. Ish, imo v'aviv, that is the object of the sentence. His mother and his father, you shall revere, singular or plural, tirao?
Plural.
But the subject of the sentence is singular.
So what's up with that?
How can the subject of the sentence be singular and the verb be plural? What it means is that this is one of those cases where ish doesn't mean ish. Ish means ish and isha. It means man and woman. Otherwise, the verb in the sentence would have fit the subject. It extends the subject by being a plural verb, and therefore we know that male children and female children have the same obligation toward the parent.
Is that a general principle of Hebrew grammar? Or is that just specific cases?
Well,
in other words, when you have a plural verb in the singular subject, okay,
in the Talmud, it will nearly always be a cause for analysis. Or at least if there's any reason to raise any possibility that there could be an interpretation that could come from that, in nearly all cases, some interpretation will come.
I always thought that things like that
happened.
Scribal.
Oh, no way. I don't know what you've been reading.
No doesn't mean you should revere them.
No. That would be tiraum. It would be a mem at the end if that were what it meant. You could say that, but.
No.
So it's a careful reading of the text, but the end result is. Now, we haven't really answered the question we started out with. We're just, the way the Talmud works. Talmud doesn't answer the question. The Talmud goes here, there, there, and then comes finally to the answer to the question. Right? It's setting up several straw men. And it knocks down the straw men. There's an advantage to knocking down the straw men because you're actually learning something along the way. Right? We're learning several of the different pieces of information which we wouldn't have known otherwise. And it's interesting stuff. We're learning about honoring of parents. As a matter of fact, it's so interesting, the Talmud itself is going to take this up in another two pages. And it's going to be the locus classicus of that subject. It's right here in this Talmud. But that's the way the Talmud works. Yes, sir?
Do we make a distinction between man and men in that often we will hear or read about man being inclusive of everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Would that be applicable here?
Could be, but it's more of a question. The Hebrew word Adam is that word which in English is translated frequently as man, which does not mean man. That's interesting. We went through this in American society. I don't know, it's 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Probably 20 years ago, 25 years ago. The gender, the desire to degenderize the language, which in English was fairly possible because we don't have a highly gendered language. In other languages, it would be absolutely impossible. Hebrew would be impossible. French would be impossible. But in English, it became a social, I shouldn't say moral issue, but sort of that. So that was sort of done in a lot of places. Today, for example, it's an issue still in preparation of prayer books, editions of the Bible, to have gender-free issues of the Bible. Well, some people like yours truly have never been very excited about that because I really think to begin with, one should read the Bible and see what it says, not what you want it to say. And that's certainly not an issue that concerns the Bible. But words like Adam are non-sexual. They are inclusive. Ish usually means man as opposed to woman. But by this analysis, you can see it's not always true. So one of the things that you see in an analysis of a literary text, like the Mishnah, is that you begin to get a feel for the latitude of the language. If there were no possible such latitude, if it were just reading something that's absolutely not there, that would be possible, but much less likely. Here I think you're seeing possible latitude in the language.
Is there some relevance to this Mishnah starting with man and or father and son?
I don't know the answer to that. All I can say is that's not addressed by the Mishnah. There could be a variety of possible relevances to it, including the way in which it's good to present an oral argument. But I think that's another subject. Okay? All right, now, remember what we've learned so far. We see that both men and women are obligated to honor the parent, to honor the parent. Well, if that's so, remember what the Mishnah said first. The beginning of the Mishnah says, Kol mitzvot ha-ben, all of the mitzvot of the child on the father, men are obligated and women are not obligated. So that if this means the child's mitzvot toward the father, we've just seen that men and women are equally obligated for the mitzvot toward the father. So that is to say, that ilema, that possibility, couldn't be true. It couldn't be true. Do you understand? No. Okay, I'll say it again. We have raised one possible reading of the Mishnah, which is, kol mitzvot ha-ben ala'av. These are the mitzvot that the child is obligated to do for the parent. I'll say the father, make it simpler. These are the mitzvot that a child is obligated toward the father. Are men and women equally obligated? No. Men are obligated, women are not obligated. If that's what it means, we got a problem. Why? Because we know that as far as mitzvot of the child toward the parent, we've just had a good example of that. Ish imo v'aviv tirau. A man, we don't know whether it means a man and a woman, but at least a man must revere his father and his mother. Child toward the parent. The Gemara itself has analyzed, the Baraita has analyzed that to mean not male child, but male child and female child. But the Mishnah is saying the obligations of the one toward the other, and we're going from the child to the parent, just the male is obligated and the female is not obligated. We are now saying that the male and the female are equally obligated. The ilema that we set up, the possibility, the first possibility that we set up, must have been a false possibility. That's all the Gemara is doing. Sets up a possibility, it knocks it down, logically, on the basis of another Baraita. Okay? We go on. Amar Rav Yehuda Hachi Kamar. Rav Yehuda has another solution. It doesn't mean the mitzvot that the child is obligated toward the parent, but hachikamar, this is what it means. Kol mitzvot haben amutalot ala'av. All mitzvot of a child which are placed on the father la'asot to do. Anashim chayavim v'nashim peturat. Men are obligated and women are not obligated.
Alright?
No? No? Now we're going to see. Tanina lahad de tanura banan. We're going to get an illustration. A baraita. The Gemara is going to bring us a baraita, which gives us an illustration of this view of Rabbi Yehuda. It goes like this. Ha'av chayav bivno lemulo. A father is required vis-a-vis his son. Here it means son. It could, in certain circumstances, mean daughter, but it's not clear. Lemulo, to circumcise him. Lifdoto, to give him a pidyon haben. Ulelamdo Torah, to teach him Torah. Ulahasio isha, to marry him to a wife. ulelamdo umanut, and to teach him a profession, teach him a craft. Fascinating. Fascinating. Here you have the obligations of a father toward the son, in particular. These are, and this is written in a time where the assumption is that the craft would be a source of a way to earn a living, and the father is obligated to take care of those things toward his son. The Yeshomrim afla hashito b'mayim. And there are those who also include the obligation to teach him how to swim. To teach him how to swim. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Kol she'eno milamed et bino omanut milamdo listut. Whoever does not teach his child a profession teaches him to be a robber. A robber, a gunner. Okay? So the Gemara then says, Listut salkadatach. Do you really mean that he teaches him how to be a robber? He's just not teaching him anything. How's he teaching him to be a robber? Ela ki'ilu melamdo listut. It is as if he is teaching him to be a robber. That is to say, if a man doesn't have a profession, he's got to do something. He's got to make a living some way. He'll make it illicitly if he can't make it licitly. And it is the obligation of the father to take care of those things for the son. Okay? So, these are the obligations of the father to the son. Father to the son. And that, then, is what it means when the Mishnah says, Kol mitzvot ha-ben ala'av, all of the mitzvot which the father is required to perform toward the son. Anashim chayevim, the father is required to do it and not the mother.
And if there is no father?
We'll have to get to that. Okay, because that could happen in a variety of ways. There could be no father, or it could be the father hasn't done it. What if a father hasn't taught his child? What if a father hasn't made a bris for a child? What if a father hasn't done a pidyon haben? Happens all the time, by the way. I have this is a recurring series of issues. The most obvious one is the study of Torah. Right? What if your father never taught you or never provided for the teacher? What happens then? Okay? So, all of these are possible thoughts that you have, but here we now see the meaning of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, which was itself hard to understand, it was very ambiguous. In fact, the Mishnah has been defined by the Gemara by use of a Braita, but first the view of Rav Yehuda, and then a Braita, which further clarifies the idea.
Quick question. If someone is not obligated to do something, and they do it anyway, is that better? Is there some value in that?
Those are two completely different things. Correct. There are three possibilities. One is that it's better. Second one is that it's not better, but there's some value in it. And the third is that you shouldn't do it. Okay? I'm not going to answer that yet. Because that's going to be a recurring question that we will have to ask. Okay? Now, having brought the Braita, the Gemara will now, it's a nice Braita, because it sort of asks in itself, how do you know these things? When we say that the father is obligated to circumcise his son, who said? Where do you know that from? How about the mother? How about the grandfather? How about the town, the court? You know, where are these obligations? Okay. All right, so the Gemara now says, Lemulo minalan. Where do we learn that it is the father's obligation to circumcise his son? And by the way, it is. It's not the moel's obligation to circumcise his son. You know that. It's the father's obligation to circumcise the son, so that the moel has to say to the father first, do you appoint me to be your agent to circumcise your son? Or would you rather do it yourself? And generally the assumption is that you prefer the mole to do it, or you wouldn't have invited the mole to come there. Okay? Once in a while, the father does circumcise his son. I've seen it. Any of you circumcise your sons?
No? I've seen it where the father actually does it.
Yeah.
Once it's set up.
Oh, that I've seen too, correct. The mole sets it up with a clamp, and then the father makes the cut. I've seen that. I had one case where the father did the whole thing. His father was a doctor, and he had decided that he was going to circumcise his son. Big mistake. He shouldn't have done that. So I'm watching this guy. I'm the rabbi. The father is there. This father is going to circumcise his son like this. So I say, take it easy. You didn't invite them all. So, I mean, the assumption is that this is going to happen. You remember Saturday Night Live did an advertisement of a car company once.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Where they do it in the back seat.
The mole goes in the back seat.
I didn't like putting it
up. goes in the back seat of the car, and the car is going boom, boom, boom all over the place. And it was to show that the car has tremendous springs, you know, it's great. And and the mole comes out and he says, "Poife." So, but the allegation is the father of the father toward the son. How do we know this? Where do we know this from? Dichtiv, because it is written, Vayamal Avraham et Yitzchak beno, and Abraham circumcised Isaac his son. Well, it says beno, his son. Okay? So, and Abraham circumcised Isaac his son. Says he did it, but does that say that he had to do it? That somebody else maybe didn't have to do it? Well, it's not so clear. So it does say that it was his son. There's no doubt about it. But it's one of these verses that's brought, it sort of answers the question, but it doesn't answer it in a compelling fashion, I think. Okay? Let's see whether there's any Rashi on this. No Rashi yet. Okay? Yamal Avraham et Yitzhak beno. Another Gemara goes on. Veheche delo mahale avuha nechai vebedin lemeale. Oh, how do we know then that if the father does not circumcise the son, that the court is the one that is obligated to circumcise the child? Dichtiv, because it says, Himo lachem kol zachar. Interesting. The Torah says, Himo lachem, Genesis 17:10, Himo lachem, circumcise lachem, to yourselves, every male child. Interesting. It could have said, make sure that every father circumcises his male child. Doesn't say that. First, we learn that Abraham circumcises his son. So, in a way, we see that a father does it for the son. Then we see that there's a broader concept here, because it says, Himol lachem. Himol is very indistinct. There's no, it's a command verb, but we don't know who the subject is. Right? So, it's Himol lachem. Make sure that your children are circumcised. And the lachem is the community, in fact. And so here the community is brought in as the backup. The backup is the community.
What about Sephora?
Wait a second. Patience, patience. Dichtivi molachem zachar. Vehecha delo male beidina. How do we know then, in a case where the court has not circumcised the child, michayv ihu lemim hal nafshe, he's required to circumcise himself. No, it's true. I mean, you don't circumcise yourself. Abraham apparently did. So it appears in the Torah. But the same way that the father doesn't usually circumcise the child either. I've had cases of this. I've had cases of men. Oh, we have many cases of this. I had a lot of cases. The biggest, we had a tremendous number of cases of Russian Jews. When the Russian Jews made Aliyah, they came to Israel. They were not circumcised. It was not done in the Soviet Union. There were no Moalim. They were generally not. It was very rare to have a Russian Jew who was circumcised. Generally, if they were circumcised abroad. And they come en masse. A million Russian Jews immigrate to Israel. A large number of them are grown men who are not circumcised. They get to Israel and they then circumcise themselves. They check into the Hadassah hospital and they got circumcised. I never forget, in the middle of the Russian immigration, tremendous numbers coming. I went with a rabbinic group to see Jews come off the planes. And then we went to a community where a lot of immigrants had gone, and we were part of the absorption process. So we saw the Jews come off the planes. It was very touching. I mean, here they come up with the fur coats and fur hats in the middle of the Israeli summer, and with violins and cellos, and you know, just an amazing sight to see. And they come off the plane, and then we went to lunch with people who had already been there for a while. So I was having lunch with a woman and her son. The son must have been about 15. So I said, you know, what do you like about Israel? You know, that was the famous Russians. And that was the time when it was a Russian joke, a Hebrew joke of the Russians. They say, on the Israeli television, it was Tagidli, says to a Russian immigrant, tell me, in one word, what do you think of Israel? So the Russian looks at the commentator and says, Tov. He says, Hashav, b'shtei milim. Now, in two words, what do you think of Israel? Lotov. Lotov, not good. Lotov, Lotov, not good. So I got to lunch with this mother and her 15-year-old son. I asked them, you know, what it's like, what it was like. So the boy wants to talk. This boy wants to talk, and he knows more Hebrew than his mother, as you would understand. The kids take this very quickly. So he says, he wants to tell us a story. Well, what's your story? He says, I went to Hadassah Hospital and I had a Brit Milah. So yeah, the rabbis, we were ready to cry. You know, we were just wiped out by this whole thing. The kid is telling you, and I'm so proud. He says, I had a Brit Milah in the Hadassah Hospital. So he says, Nifnei ze hayiti Yehudi. Before this, I was a Jew. Achshav ani Yisraeli. Oh. And now I am an Israeli. And in a way, it's upside down. It's upside down, but you could see the force of the whole thing. It was true, because he could finally be a Jew, because he was now an Israeli, you know. So that was this tremendous sense of pride. So, in fact, you can do it yourself. You can do it yourself, and that's what people did.
In case the Russian Jew or any other Jew that wasn't circumcised and he passed away, he's not allowed to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. So how did this
who said in Israel? Who said that?
This is what I think, maybe I'm wrong.
It's not true. Not true. Not if he's Jewish. We have a custom, came to be a custom of circumcising people even after they're dead. But it's no obligation. I cannot speak for the Chevra Kadisha in your local Israeli cemetery. I cannot speak for that. I can only speak for what the halacha is.
Because we have a family. My family adopted a Polish Jew to Israel at 60s after the war. And he's related to us. And he wasn't circumcised because of the history in Poland. And my father wanted him to circumcise. And he didn't want to do it. He was like 18, 19. And he promised my father he would do it prior to his death. Not my father's death, but my adopted brother. And my father died, and there is no policeman right now. And we knew that he would not be able to bury it in Israel, and in a Jewish cemetery.
I don't want
so to I don't know how the issue...
Fine, do it.
Oh, I...
Tell him he's got to do it. All right? That's the most important thing in the circumstances. Right. Don't put it off. The more you put it off, the harder it is.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Yeah, the whole generation who were born after the exodus from Egypt, that's to only circumcise...
When they come into the land of Israel.
Before,
we read it in the Torah reading, in the Haftarah a few weeks ago.
So
there the father was not the one, that generation of the parents had died out, didn't they? By the time they were circumcised.
Probably you're right. Correct. But that's what we're saying. It's not an only obligation of the father. It is an obligation of the father. If the father doesn't do it, then the community is obligated. If the community doesn't do it, then the person is obligated to arrange for it, however it can be arranged for.
But not the mother.
That's the interesting thing. Okay, so far we have not seen any mention of the mother. We have not seen any mention of the mother. All right, now comes the next one. Ihi minalam delo michayva. How do we know that a mother is not obligated? Because after all, is not obligated. So here we're seeing the mother is not obligated. Because we saw that, remember the Mishnah. The Mishnah says all of the mitzvot of the father, which the father has to do for the son, the man is obligated and the woman is not obligated. That means the mother is not obligated. So how do we know that? How do we know a mother is not obligated? Okay? Dichtiv ka'asher tziva oto Elohim. As God had commanded him. Oto velo ota. Him and not her. Okay? God commanded Abraham and not Sarah. God commanded Abraham. That's Rashi here. Velo et Sarah. Velo et Sarah. Let me go a little bit further. I want to go a little bit further first. See, I'm running out of time. Okay. Otova lo ota. Ashkachan miyat. Well, all we are learning when we made when we saw our initial verse, we learned that Abraham had circumcised his son, which God commanded him. Well, how do we know, even though we know that there is a command to circumcise children throughout all the generations, how do we know that what we have learned about Abraham is true throughout all of the generations? Okay? Because that's not to be necessarily assumed. We know that Abraham is commanded, Sarah is not commanded. We know that Jews are commanded throughout the ages to do it. But how do we know that the commandment of Abraham, which is a commandment to him and not to his wife, also applies throughout all of the ages? That's what the Gemara wants to know. Ashkachan miyad. We know in that circumstances immediately. Lidarot minalam. How do we know that this applies throughout all the generations? Tana de Rabbi Yishmael. Okay, the Academy of Rabbi Yishmael taught, Kol makom shene matzav. Every place where the Torah uses the verb tzav, command, eno elezeruz miyad uledorot, is to accelerate them for now and for all future generations. Zeruz dichtiv v'tzav et Yehoshua v'chazkeo v'yamtzeu. The command strengthen him and fortify him implies zeruz zeal. You had a better word. What did you say, Ron?
Accelerate.
It's all the same thing. Miyadu l'dorot dichtiv, now and for the future, as it is written, min ayom asher tziva Hashem v'hala l'dorot echem. That's in Parshat Shlach, where we have mitzvot for the future generations, because already in Parshat Shlach the generation is told that they're going to die in the desert, And immediately prior to that is the mitzvah of challah. And the it said in the context, min hayom asher tziva Hashem v'hala ledorot echem. From the time that the Lord has tziva, that he commanded, challah l'chol ledorot echem, forward throughout the generations. So, by juxtaposition of language, this is learned every time you have the word tziva, it becomes a word that includes both zeruz and ledorot. Right? Do it with zeal, and it has to be done on a perpetual basis. It's perpetual. It's a perpetual command. Okay? Now, yes?
During the Roman occupation of Jerusalem, Jews were forced to circumcision, to reverse the circumcision. All the Jews were forced to reverse.
So do they have to again to circumcise to become Jew again or not? Again, you don't become Jewish by being circumcised. You have not observed, fulfilled the mitzvah of circumcision. Let's say you're not circumcised. Are you Jewish? Yes. A circumcision is a symbol in the flesh of the covenant with Abraham. To begin with, there is 50% of the population that is not circumcised. Right? They happen to be women. So, they're Jewish. Okay? Not only that, they're very Jewish. And the rest of the population of men, if they're not circumcised, are still Jewish. But they have not fulfilled the mitzvah of circumcision. Now, undoubtedly, circumcision has a social and a symbolic context as well, as in that story that I just told you, or in the historical events that you're referring to here, where it becomes very symbolic of a great number of things that are connected with Jews. But what we are seeing here is that still you have the mitzvah. You have the mitzvah of doing it. If it was undone, you have to redo it. Because that's the mitzvah. Okay, now. What we have learned, and we are going to now begin the next piece of the Braita, which is Pidyon HaBen. So, in a way, we finished the subject of circumcision. But before we finish the subject of circumcision, Barry, you raised the problem. What was the problem? There is the problem of Tzipora. A very interesting problem. Remember the story of Tzipora in the Bible. Right? Moses and Tzipora are going back to Egypt. They've been in Midian. Going back to Egypt, they have a son. And that son apparently has not been circumcised. Right? Moses apparently gets very ill. And she then circumcises the child. And it's a very odd portion. Even what I've said to you is not so clear. I've made it a little clearer than it is in the portion. But in fact, she does circumcise. Not only that, in general, question. Is a woman allowed to be a Moel? Is a woman allowed to be a Moel? A Moel. From what we have read so far, seems to me obvious that the answer would be no. However, it's not so obvious. One of the things when you read the Mishnah, and even when you read the Beraita, which seems to define the terms quite clearly, is that, in fact, this issue was discussed elsewhere in the Gemara. The subject is discussed in Masechet Avodah Zarah, Daf Kaf Zayin Amud Aleph, where a variety of other possibilities are raised, even the Gentile. And there the question is raised in terms of the expertise of a Gentile. What if a Gentile has expertise that a Jew doesn't have? Is it permissible for a Gentile to do it? Well, interestingly enough, there are two points of view. One says yes, one says no. But the fact that one could say yes is quite extraordinary. quite extraordinary. Then there are a variety of other possibilities that are raised, because there are some people in the land of Israel who are not Gentiles and questionable Jews, like Kutim, Kuthites. So it's raised as far as these questionable Jews of questionable status. And there are, in fact, two verses of the Torah that are cited numerous times. One is the verse that says, "Ve'ata et briti tishmor." You shall keep my covenant. You shall keep my covenant. All right? Now, you shall keep my covenant. That is to say, those of you who have my covenant shall keep my brit. Who has the covenant? A Jew. But interestingly enough, actually more than 50% of the Jews have the covenant. You know how many Jews have the covenant? All Jews have the covenant.
But why doesn't it say Tishmaru then?
No, but that's the male and the female.
It's not defined in any way. Well, it could be what you said. That's possible. Could be that it's referring just to the male. That's possible. But there's yet another verse. Torah also says, Himol Yimol. Himol Yimol. Himol Yimol. Can be read in the Gemara here, it's interpreted as possibly being read as Hamol Yimol. Hamol Yimol. Which could be read, have two different meanings. Could be Hamal, the one who could be circumcised, will do the circumcision. Could be Hamol, which is that one could either cause the circumcision or do the circumcision. So certain people might have a part in it, but not a complete part in it. We've just sort of gotten ourselves some wiggling room, as it were. Let me just read to you, I'll read to you quickly. These two verses are used vis-a-vis Gentiles, vis-a-vis Kutites. And then the Gemara says, well, another possibility for the fact that you have two different verses with different implications that come from these verses are Ike benai hu isha. That if you cite one or the other verse, one verse will allow you to permit women to be moalim, the other verse will not allow you to permit women to be moalim. Okay? And then it goes into some detail of those two verses to prove one or the other. Okay? I'm just going to skip that because I'm running out of time. I want to read to you the end of this. Umi ika lamande damar isha la. Can there possibly be anyone who says that a woman is not fit to perform circumcision? V'hakati v'tikach tzipora tzor. Because it says, and Tzipora took the flint and did the circumcision. So how could you have ever thought that a woman couldn't do circumcision? Because you have a biblical source for it. Krebe v'tikach. Ah, sorry. Krebe vatakach. Read it not as tikach, she took the flint, but she caused the flint to be taken. She caused the flint to be taken. Vahakativ tichrot. But it says, but she cut. She cut. Krebe tachret. No, you can also read that, in fact, it's true. You can read it as tachret. She should cause it to be cut. Which is to say, she did part of the job, but Moses did the finishing part of the job. Atyehi v'adchala, she began it. V'ata Moshe v'agmara, and Moshe finished it. Well, what's the law? I'm going to read to you the Shulchan Aruch. This is the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Hakol kasherin lamo. Everyone is kosher to perform circumcision. Afilu eved, a slave. Isha, a woman. Vikatan, and a minor. The Arel Yisrael, and a Jew who is not circumcised. And a Jew is not circumcised. Here the logic is, and this is a logic we're going to see again and again, that a person, one might assume, that the only ones who are permitted to do this are the people who themselves have the obligation, or it could be done to them. Right? With the woman, the issue that I didn't read to you was, in the commentators, whether when it says my covenant, of course the woman is in the covenant. She is also a part to the covenant. So perhaps this extends it to the woman. And in fact, you see that according to the law, it does. The Im Yesh Yisrael Gadol Shiodea Lamul. But if there is an adult, and the assumption is here, male Jew, who knows how to circumcise, Hu Kodem Lekulam. He takes precedence over all the others. So you see, in a way, there is a compromise now between these different portions of the Talmud. Because it seemed evident from the Baraita we were reading that it was clear that there's an obligation only for men and not for women. The other piece of Talmud extends it also by making the citation to Tzipora, by showing that it was possible. Of course, it's before the Torah is given on Mount Sinai, so you know one could also have that obligation. But you see that the rabbis are willing to extend it here. Okay? And this is the comment then, and then it says, V'chein nohagin, this is still the Shulchan Aruch says, and it is customary, lahader achar ish, to look for a man, rather than to have the woman do it. Aval oved kochavim, but a pagan, afilu hum mahul lo yamul klal, but a pagan, even if he is circumcised, cannot perform the circumcision. That's another subject. It's not so obvious why. The im mal ein tzarich lachzor v'lamul pam shenit. I want to go a little bit further. That was in the parentheses there. That was the position of the Ramah. The Ashkenazi commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, it was the Ramah who said, we have to go and search for a man. It's customary to go and search for a man. All of that is to say that a woman could do it. That a woman can do it. So, my purpose in bringing you this extra Talmud and bringing you the Shulchan Aruch is to again expand upon the way in which one understands the text. One might have thought, even after we read the Baraita, that it was a simple issue. It's not such a simple issue. It is somewhat simple, and we see a hierarchy of obligations here. But when it finally comes down to it, we do not see an either-or. We see something that on the surface appeared to be either-or, and when it came down to it, it was a lot grayer than one would have expected. Questions? Barry first.
I'm sorry. I'd like to go back to the original fundamental assumption, and that is that mitzvot are logically separated by time dependence or not, and that somehow aligns with gender. And I've heard interpretations that since women have responsibilities in the household, that they may not be able to fulfill time-dependent mitzvot.
For that, I gave you Rabbi Berman's article.
Oh, okay.
Okay? That's the kind of stuff he deals with there, and I don't want to deal with it for yet another few weeks,
okay,
because it's going to be a central subject of the Talmud when we get to it. Okay? Yes.
This situation where the woman is available, but you indicated that if there's a man available, the risk should be done by the male. Is there an obligation for the male to do it, or is the woman permitted to do it anyway?
I don't know the answer to that. Because it could go one way, it could go the other way.
It's permissible.
It's absolutely permissible. And the question is, who's available? What does it mean? Does expertise have anything to do with this? I was reading of a case where it meant a great deal to a particular family that a certain woman doctor who was a Mohelet, that she do it. So that was a compelling reason. It's like a very compelling reason. There are many places in this country where there are a lack of Mohelim and Mohelot. But in fact, it turns out that a woman is permitted to do it.
On the question of a woman being permitted to perform a circumcision, is there differentiation between a woman and the mother of the baby?
No. No, there's no. Certainly, the mother of the baby has no obligation. Okay? But in terms of people who are able to actually do it, the father is the only one who has the obligation. It's a good point, actually, because it brings us back to where we started. The father has the obligation. But as far as being the mohel goes, though the father is required to do it, the woman, in fact, can actually do it, but she doesn't have the obligation. Especially if she's a doctor. If she's qualified. And that would mean actually being a doctor, but being more than a doctor in the circumstances.
She would have to be a Jewish doctor.
Correct. Well, no, she would have to be a Jewish Mohel. She wouldn't have to be a doctor.
No, I mean the doctor who was the Mohelet would have to be Jewish.
Yes, correct.
I'm surprised with the comment that a non-Jew, even if he's circumcised, cannot perform Brit Milah, because so many Jews lived in Muslim countries, you'd think they had the
that's exactly the discussion.
Greatest experts.
That is the discussion. But I had one final story, and then you have to go home. This was another Brit Milah where I was the rabbi of Egyptian Jews. A member of a congregation I was associated with, the woman, in fact, was an Egyptian Jew. Many Egyptian Jews in the family. And this, they had a cousin who was going to be the Mohel. And they had moved in 1956, this entire family, there wasn't a small family, a small family of 90 people, had moved, they were French-speaking, so they moved first to France, and then from France, they split up, half came to New York, and the other half went to Montreal. Montreal, obviously, because it was French-speaking, and there was a major Sephardi community that still is in Montreal, because at that very time, the Egyptian Jews, some of the Algerian Jews went to Montreal when they came out. So I said, well, who's the Mohel? Our cousin is a famous Mohel from Cairo. Okay. So I go to this Brit Milah where I have, I'm going to name the baby, and there's the cousin who's the famous. So I said, well, where did he learn Milah? Milah, not only was he the Mohel for the Jews, he was the Mohel for all the Arabs. For all the Arabs. And he was the most famous Mohel. So he then does the Brit Milah. Oh, God help us and save us. He was terrible.
Oh.
He was just terrible, this guy. So I said, what does he do for a living? He's a butcher in Montreal. That's what he should have been doing for a living, this guy.
Well, just a quick question here. This seems weak. The obligation, that there was no obligation for a woman. The argument seems to be because